Luke 14, and the verse I'm going to read from, let me get the right verses in front of me, my scripture Bible here, is 15, verse 14, 15, if you want to follow, which is the parable of the great banquet. Okay? When one of those who were at the table with him heard this, he said to Jesus, "Blessed is the one who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." Jesus replied, "A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, 'Come, for everything is now ready.' But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, 'I've just bought a field. I must go and see it. Please excuse me.' Another said, 'I have just bought 5 yoke of oxen. I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me.' Still another said, 'I just got married, so I can't come.' The servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered the servant, 'Go out quickly into the streets and the alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame.' So the servant said, 'What you have ordered has been done, but there is still room.' Then the master told the servant, 'Go out to the roads and country lanes and compel them to come in, so that my house will be full. I tell you, not one of those who are invited will get a taste of my banquet.'" Lord, thank you for this morning. Thank you that we can gather together as your family, as those invited to the table. We thank you for your work amongst us. We ask that we might have words and ears to hear you, minds that are soft and hearts that are soft to your truth and to your promptings, lives that are ready to be transformed. Amen. So when I first got this passage, which George kindly divvied up all the different things, then you get your, we organized who was going to preach, I had to chuckle. Because if you have been looking at Luke 14 as part of our series, you will note that in the verses that follow this little section, this is the actual verse, and this being Mother's Day, you will chuckle. "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple." So I had to definitely chuckle when I got that. I was like, that's a perfect verse for today. It's not actually the focus that I want to bring today, because it's actually awkward, but I will say this. In the Gospel of Luke, things begin to sort of get heated up as you go through the Gospel. And we seem to have more and more extreme statements from Jesus. And statements of extreme grace followed by statements of extreme cost. And I think that we need to see those things working like a song, like the notes following a song, that they're working in tandem together. And so today we're looking at a passage of extreme grace, and it's followed by a passage of extreme cost. So I don't know what you've been up to this morning, but this morning I woke up at 7 and I put on the slow roast pork for lunch. And then I prepared breakfast, and then I prepared for this morning as well. I mean, I'd done preparation before, don't worry. But I was just printing off a few things, just thinking through last things. And I have to say that these two things, cooking and eating and teaching and preaching, are two of the things that I think possibly I was put on earth to do. And so I come this morning joyful because I've got to do these things. And sometimes it's just a special thing, won't you, when you kind of sense, this is what I was put on earth to do. And so I've done the cooking. Well, that will carry on after this, but now we're going to do the preaching. I spend, as I am a sort of cook and love eating, I spend far too much of my time thinking about food. I don't know about you, but I consider what I'm going to have for breakfast, what I'm going to make the family. I do most, if not all, the cooking. I don't know. In our family. So I think about what we're going to have for breakfast, and then I think about what we're going to have for lunch, and then I consider what we're going to have for tea. And I like the snow break, because I got to cook things I don't normally have time for. That's what I used my snow time to do. So I made gnocchi, which I have only made once or twice before, and I love doing that. Food is important to me, but food is important to us all, isn't it? Whether we like food and whether we like cooking, but it's fuel. It's essential for life, so no matter what it is. But it's also essential for who we are. Food is a great mirror, a window into all that we are as societies, communities. Now, when anthropologists, someone who studies communities and societies, go to a new tribe, a new community, one of the first things that he or she is going to study is the way they eat. What they eat, the way they eat, the form, the structures. Because in eating and drinking together, you find just about all the pictures of what a society is like. Sounds like a strange thing, but I think you can see the big things about what a society is like. Their economics, their politics, the relations between different generations, their diet, their health. All these things can be reflected in the way that we eat and drink together. Now, it's difficult to see that for our society, but if you thought about it this afternoon, if you really want to, you can think about that and consider what it might say about our society. But let me give you a worked example. So, I was brought up in the Middle East. In the Middle East, eating and drinking together, hospitality, is the most important social interaction. Eating and drinking together is the way that you form community, make connection, make new friends, strengthen those bonds, and go forward. And if you look at the way they eat and drink, you can tell an awful lot. So let me tell you what happens when you go to an Arab Muslim's house. So my parents spent a long time learning Arabic, and so we had a lot of Muslim Arabic friends, and we had the chance to go to people's houses, which is a great privilege to really see how people ate and drank and lived in the house. You walk in, the first thing you do is take your shoes off. You never walk into an Arab's home with shoes on. And then you'd be separated, men, women. The men would go into a sitting room, and women would go to another sitting room. Unless you knew them particularly well, if they were like family, we had people who were like family to us, even though they weren't technically, and sometimes we'd share, but usually men and women. And you go into the sitting room, and there'd be no chairs. You go in, and there was very little, actually. What they'd have is like little sponge mattresses on the floor, right? They were covered, like flowery things, like Arabs love flowery things. And you'd sit down, and you would recline like a Roman, like you see kind of like lean on your shoulders and this. And you'd have, and I used to have one, you used to have like a white thobe, which is like a white dress, goes down to there. And you kind of sit, or you crouch, or you kneel, whatever, and you chat. And then very, very sweet tea gets served to you in tiny little glasses. And then after a while, you eat. Now, almost every time you went to someone's house, you would eat. You didn't necessarily have a coffee culture where you'd have coffee and cake. You ate a meal. And so in would come this like mound of food on a platter, like more food than you could possibly eat. And there's a reason for that. And you'd all sit down and you'd gather around this one platter and you'd either have a spoon or you eat with your hands. And everyone eat from the same platter, which would make a number of us very awkward. You know, we're not used to that. It's a really sort of, I'm used to it, but when you have people and you say, let's eat from a central platter, people just go like, I just don't have the sort of mindset for that. Because it's quite complicated, because you're like, you know, how much do I eat? You know, do I eat too much meat? Have I eaten too much vegetables? Has my neighbor got enough? And then the funny thing is, it's a very, very intimate, I mean, I think all eating actually is a very intimate activity. It reveals enormous about who we are, about what we prefer, what our houses are like, all these things. And when you're eating with your hands, it's even more intimate because you have to trust that people have washed their hands. Otherwise, you know, you could get a disease. So you're eating with your hands and you squash into, like, you get rice, you squash into a ball and stick into your mouth. Now, you eat from this platter, but there's more food than you can eat because for an Arab, the greatest thing, the greatest insult to be a host is that there wasn't enough food. So you always cook way more than you can do. And if you go to an Arab's house, it's a heads up, don't finish the food on your plate because they'll keep on filling it and you'll keep on eating and you'll start to feel sick and they'll start to get upset. So just, you know, you can have more than one plate. They're quite happy that if you're having a single plate. But just be warned. If you keep on eating it, they'll keep on filling it. So you eat and there's more enough food than you can eat. Then what happens is that platter would go through to the women's sitting room and they would eat what was left, which tells you enormous about that society, about the prominence of males and in comparison to females. They might heat it up, but they would eat the same food that we'd eaten, but they'd eat the seconds. And then after that, it would be cleared, and then you'd have, after that, they didn't do puddings in the Middle East. You get like super sweet things that were made from a bakery, like tiny little bright orange little swirly things, or like Turkish delight, and everything was covered in rose water, and unbelievably sweet, and I hated rose water for many years. I'm now getting over that, just because of that experience. So it tells you enormous about Middle Eastern culture, about hospitality. I've got time to tell you one last one. When we went to one certain part of Saudi, if you go to someone, this area's house, if you stay with them, the last day, you get offered an eyeball. You must always be offered the eyeball. If you eat the eyeball from the sheep, you have to stay another 3 days. And so my dad, when we went to this region of Saudi, he was warned, you will be offered an eyeball of a sheep and you must not take it if you don't want to stay for another 3 days. Because if you do, you are honor bound to stay. And so you have to sort of know these sort of rules. But a deep connection. So hospitality in the Middle East is really significant. Eating is really significant. The other thing that's really telling is that whenever you went, rich or poor, people had basically the same food. Rice, meat, vegetables. You might get less or more. And you might get Coke if it was like, you know, if it was particularly, you know, Western or something like that. But it was largely the same. And I think, obviously, you know, from the Middle East is unbelievably wealthy people. But the structures, the divisions between different classes wasn't there in the same way that we have in our society. We ate just generally the same thing. Now, as I say, eating and hospitality was enormously important. It was the basis of society, I would argue, in the Middle East. It's so, so important. Now, in Jesus' day, this was exactly the same. The Middle Eastern culture, it's the same in that way. But arguably even more so. Because for Jesus and the Jews of his time, food and eating was the principle, arguably the principal symbol of being God, in being God's kingdom and being God's people. Because the Jews, as you will know, have specific eating laws they keep to this day. They have certain eating habits they have to go through during the year. They can't eat pork, but there's a whole number of things in the Old Testament which we wonder at and go, why in the world would God ask you to do that? And partly I think it's hygiene, but partly because I think it's symbolic. You are a set-apart people. And so food, not only what you ate, but how you ate and who you ate was incredibly important. It was a theological, societal, political, economic declaration. And therefore, it was very, very significant. And when you have a society, particularly in Israel, we have the Israelites, you have the Samaritans who lived in close proximities. You also have some Romans and some Greeks. But for the Jews who were out spread around all the Mediterranean, they were sharing their lives with all these people who they call pagans or Gentiles. And the eating laws was the one thing that would set them apart in their community, and therefore it was very, very significant. So when we come across Jesus eating, talking about eating, going to meals, all these things, it's highly important, and we need to take real care and attention. And today's chapter is that par excellence. It's like Luke 14 is that. But Luke is particularly, apparently, interested in meals. In the whole of Luke, there's like eight or nine meals mentioned, which is more than any other gospel. And a famous sort of biblical scholar called Robert Karras did a book on Luke, and he said he named it Eating Your Way Through Luke, because he suggested that the meals of Luke was actually the way the story progressed. And he said this, which I love. In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus is either going to a meal, having a meal, or leaving a meal, which is a really interesting. And this part of the Gospel of Luke, in the journey to Jerusalem, that's exactly what he seems to be either having meals, leaving meals, going to meals, or talking about meals. And this passage is a great example. It starts, as we're going to look at in a moment, in a Pharisee's house. And that's the whole context for this part of this Luke. Then he leaves, and then Luke 15, he's then being accused of eating with sinners. So he's gone for a meal, had a little wonder, said some stuff, and then went to a sinner's house and ate with them. So this is what he seems to be doing. So that's the kind of, to give us an introduction, to give us a sense of where we're going. And we'll look at what this actual passage has got to say. So the setting was, here's to say, he was in a Sabbath house. So he was in a Pharisee's house on a Sabbath. And clearly this is the good and the great of the society, the top people. And Jesus had been invited because he's like their day's rock star. We'll discuss that another way. But anyway, you know what I mean. He's the man of the moment. And so you've got all the big Pharisees. The Pharisee would invite his close family, his friends, his business colleagues, the people from the temple. But it would be in the top part of society. And they're all there together. And they're like, it's going to be a good time. They've managed to bag Jesus. But that suddenly, imagine if you were hosting this, you're suddenly thinking this wasn't such a good idea. Because as soon as Jesus rocks up, he starts doing things that are deeply disturbing. First of all, it's a Sabbath. A man rocks up with a damaged hand. And Jesus says, shall I heal him? And everyone's like, And he's like, and then he does. He heals him and says, if you cannot treat this man, you treat ox who get lost on a Sabbath with more grace and love than you do a man who needs healing. And then he's watching, right? So the next bit is all about taking a seat of honor. Now, we kind of read this and think, oh, it's a nice theoretical sort of thing. When you think about it, it's deeply insulting because Jesus is watching people literally jostle for the seat of honor. So in the Middle East, in this culture, the closer you were to the host, the more honored you were. And so they come in, and this is moments where you start thinking, where am I in this spectrum of all the people in society? You know, am I this close? Am I here? Or am I here? And you're all jostling, and obviously you want to get as close as possible because it's the way that you kind of mark yourself in society. It's highly significant. So Jesus is actually watching, and then he says this. What you should do is not seek to get as close to the host. You should try and seek to get the worst seat. And then, if the host thinks you're in the wrong seat, he can move you up. That's an awkward thing. I mean, Jesus says that in front of everybody when they've just done that, and he's criticized everybody in the room and their sort of social way of functioning. So it's quite difficult. And then lastly, in front of the host, in front of this big gathering, he says this. When you throw a big banquet, and it sounds like it's hypothetical, but he's literally in a banquet, so it's not hypothetical. He says, don't invite the good and the great and everybody and your friends and your family and your associates. What you should invite, who you should invite, is the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. People who cannot repay you. You'll get your rewards in heaven. So like by this time, if you're a host, you're thinking, this was a bad idea. Never again. It's awkward. And then you have this great sort of shout out. This man interjects. This is the beginning of the last little section. So he says this. When one of the table heard this, and you'll notice this has nothing to do with anything that Jesus has been talking really about, apart from the fact that Jesus said, when you get to heaven, you'll get a repayment. This man shouts out, blessed is the one who will eat in the feast of the kingdom of heaven. Now, this is like a basic sort of shout out, like a sort of thing you'd say in a meal. It'd be like, isn't it good? We're all here today, and we're going to be blessed. We're like the good people. We're the people in the in crowd. We're like the Pharisees, the people who know the Torah. We're the people who follow the Torah. We're the good and the great. We've managed to get all the riffraff out. And isn't it blessed that we'll one day get to eat in the kingdom of heaven? It's not just a statement about blessed is the one, but the implication is blessed are we that we'll get to eat in the kingdom of heaven. Now, this was not us. This was a standard sort of thing that people would say at a meal. And then there would have been a standard response. And you kind of go, yes, isn't it great? And that's how you kind of move on. But Jesus, he sort of breaks convention as he's like to do. And he tells this story. Now, this story is a parable of the great banquet. And I'll be glad to tell you, it's not very complicated. What you read is what you get. The story and the meaning is really clear. But let's just unpack it a tiny bit more to kind of hopefully push into some of the details. So, the first thing I'd like to say before we kick in is the context is a small rural town or village. We know that because the man invites all these people locally and he sends a servant out to go and tell them that it's time to come to banquet. So it can't be a great city because you would be gathering people from all around. And also there's only so many lame and blind people as we'll see that fill his house. So it's a small community in which everyone's known. That's important because it gives us the context. The fact that when a person throws a great banquet in this culture, you know about it. It's the big event. The whole village is geared up. I used to go to, we used to get invited to weddings in the Middle East, and it was my least favorite thing. Because you used to go on for days, and you have to kind of go back to it again, and go back to it again. And it was just very dull, because I didn't know Arabic. So you'd sit there and listen to people speaking Arabic the whole time. You got some good food, that was the thing. And you sometimes got a bit of cash as well, I think I remember. But everybody knows about it. That's the important thing, is everybody knows about it. It's the most exciting thing that's going on in the village, in the town, okay? So he sends an invite, and this is what we do, exactly what we do. He sends an invite to the people in the town, his colleagues, his people, and his sort of social status, and then they tell him if he's going to come, they're going to come, okay? Just like we do. If we put on a party, if we put on a wedding, you send invites out, and you get the invites back, and you say, okay, so we're going to cook for 100, we're going to cook for 50. And then as you decide if you're going to kill a calf, a cow, a sheep, a goat, and you can make your decision. You decide how much wine you're going to buy, and then you decide how many servants. You might get some extra servants to be serving. So it's all important. So that's the first invite. And then what we have is, it says this, at the time of the banquet, so once everything's prepared, he sends a servant to tell those who have been invited, come, for everything is now ready. Now, this isn't a second invitation, because they've already said they're going to come. This is an opportunity. This is when you're telling people, in a society without clocks, you're saying, the food is hot. It's time to come. And he's calling, the servant is now calling people to fulfill the commitment they've made. They made a commitment to come, and he's now calling that commitment in, saying, right now, you said you're going to come, and now's your chance to come, so come along. But here's a surprise. He gets excuses. And it says they all alike began to make excuses. Now, clearly we have three excuses. It says they all alike. Not some of them, not just three, but all alike. It wouldn't be a banquet if you had three people. So there's more than three people who excuse themselves, but here's our examples. I have bought a field and must go and see it. Please excuse me. Now, we all can tell that's a rubbish excuse, can't we? In our society, an equivalent would be you had a party and invited someone and said, I just saw a house online and I bought it. I haven't seen it before. Now, not many of us, I think, have the wealth we could just buy houses online just from pictures. We want to rock up and we want to see it because it's too important to spend that sort of money on a house without having seen it. But moreover, if you've bought a house, right, it's yours. The transaction has gone past. There's no time limit. So they can see the house. You can see the house today or tomorrow or next week or next month. You own the house. It's gone. But in this society, it's even more ridiculous. Land was incredibly scarce and incredibly important. It was seen actually as holy. The land was a gift from God. The land, and therefore purchasing land, is like a spiritual exercise as much as an economic one. But even more so, you're in the Middle East, and when do they eat? They eat in the evenings because it's cooler. So there's no light. You can't see the field. It is a thinly veiled insult. It is no excuse at all. It has been designed to insult the host. But he softens the blow, saying, please, can you excuse me? The second one is just as terrible. He's bought 5 oxen. So the same rules applies. He's bought the oxen, the transaction is gone, so he can see him tomorrow. It's also dark. You can't see oxen working in the dark. You're just stupid. But moreover, with oxen, you can never buy without trying. You can have the most Olympian-shaped oxen. I don't know what they are. But, you know, the best-looking oxen, you can have 2 of them, and they can look fantastic. But if they can't work together, they're totally useless. You can never buy oxen without trying them. You'd be a fool, a great fool. And this guy's bought 10 of them, 5 pair of oxen. In the market, when you went to buy oxen, there would be a little patch of ground, and you could actually just jump on the plow and plow the oxen to make sure. Or the farmer who was selling them would invite them and say, I'm selling some oxen. Anyone wants to come and try them out in my field on Wednesday, come along. And you try the oxen out. And lastly, I said it already, it's dark. It's a ridiculous excuse. It's a thinly veiled insult. But he does also soften the blow. And the last one is not thinly veiled. It's just an insult. I just got married, so I can't come. Now, to us, we kind of think, oh, well, that's maybe the best of them all. I mean, it's maybe the honeymoon, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, you could justify that. But that isn't the case. First of all, to mention your marriage status or your wife in this sort of thing would have been disgraceful. It would have been not the right thing to do. You don't mention your wife and your marriage status in a public discourse with somebody else. That would be off the record. You wouldn't do that. Second of all, they didn't have such thing as honeymoons. And if you were married, you'd be delighted to bring you and your wife to this occasion because you get to show the community off. We just got married. We're part of the site. This would be a moment in which to unveil your marriage status and to cement your status in the community. So I can't come. He doesn't even excuse himself. It's just an insult. So we feel for the host, don't we? Because you can see the hurt and anger that would cause if you were the host. You know, that's a feeling when you put on a party yourself and you think, you know, you said start at 8 and at 8:05, you're like, there's nobody there. And you're like, this could be bad. And then you just wait and you wait and somebody turns up and like, phew, at least there's one. We know, we can relate to this story, can't we? So why would these people do this? Why would they give excuses? Well, I think it's obvious they want to insult him. In a society when hosting, we would be deeply insulted if all the guests just didn't turn up. We'd be insulted. But in a society in which your status, your role and place in society is determined by who you eat with and where you eat, and this is a public, big feast, the whole village would know about it, and they don't turn up, that would be deeply insulting. But also, it would seem to me that these people have colluded with each other in order that the feast might be cancelled. Because if no one turns up, there is no party. All you have is a whole bunch of meat and rice and some wine and some servants and lots of egg on your face. They are working together to destroy the event that the host would put on. But how does he respond? Well, he responds in anger, which is understandable. And then he says, go quickly into the streets and the alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. It's exactly the same 4 people listed at the beginning of the passage when Jesus says, don't invite your mates, invite the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. And here he says, go and invite those people. That's meant to be connected. That's meant to be important. They're meant to be seen together. So the host, rather than cancelling the party, decides to take even more sort of shame and dishonour because he invites people who are the outside of society. And these are the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame. And what we often forget is we could see in our own society people who are in those status, we'd see them as disadvantaged, on the fringe of society, facing greater risks. And some people would not want to associate with them. You know, we can see that in our newspapers, the way that people are alienated, described, labeled, and pushed aside. But in Jesus' society, it's even greater because they had a belief that if you were poor, crippled, blind, and lame, it was your fault. That status was a sign of your sin, or, tragically, the sign of your father's sin, or his father's sin, or his father's sin, three generations. So that status, imagine living in a society in which you're facing all these difficulties, all these problems by being poor, crippled, blind, and lame. And moreover, people just go, well, you deserve it. Because the rich people, they've been blessed by God. Riches and health and strength, these are seen as a blessing, a sign of God's blessing on you and your life. And so they're doubly shameful, these people. And yet the host says, no, I'll have them in. And the servant comes back and says, well, we've done that. We're in a small town. We still have got more space. And so the host says, go out to the roads and the country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. I tell you, not one of those who are invited will get to taste of my banquet. And here, the man's been sent out, the servant's been sent out to people who they have no connection with. And the implication in this parable, I mean, it's not for definite, would be go and collect the Gentiles. Go and collect the people who are not in the Israelites. Go and get people who are not our people. Go and get the people who are strangers. Go and get the people who even are labeled as our enemies. Go and get those people. I'll have them in my house too. That would seem to be the implication. You can't definitely say that, but it would seem to be the implication. It's not those in your family, not in those in your community, not those people in Israel, but go and get the Gentiles. Go and get the enemies. Go and get those that we're frightened of. And bring them into my house. And so we have a beautiful picture of the grace of God, of a host that will take on all the cost, all the shame, and will not be stopped in his pursuit to invite all and for his house to be full. And this isn't the first time that the picture of eating and feasting is used in the scriptures. It seems to be used over and over again as a picture of God, a picture of what he's doing, a picture of our problems. It's mentioned first in Genesis 3. It's amazing to think in Genesis 3, what's the cause of all the problems? It's a broken meal. Adam and Eve eat a fruit they should not eat, and they eat without God. In the garden, there was community. It doesn't talk about eating and drinking, but the picture is of a community together. In the Middle East, a community together is one that eats and drinks together. But Adam and Eve decide to eat alone and eat forbidden fruit. And so that communion between God and Adam and Eve is broken up. But God is loving and will not stop. Just like this host, he is compelled and compelling that he might bring us back together again. And how does it all end? We see in Revelation 19, the great marriage feast. That's how it's described. And even in Revelation 22, when it describes the New Jerusalem, that amazing kind of spiritual picture of this new city. And the center of that new city, what is there? There's a river and there's fruit. Eating and drinking lies in the center of God's hope for humanity renewed in his image. This image that's seen in Revelation flows out of many images in the scriptures, but let me read you one of the most powerful ones that touches on Jesus' life and what he did for us and our hope in the future. So this is Isaiah verse 6. Sorry, Isaiah 25 verse 6. You need to know what the chapter is, otherwise you've spent a long time looking. The Lord who commands armies will hold a banquet for all the nations on this mountain. At this banquet, there will be plenty of meat and aged wine. Notice that. Not just any wine, but aged wine. Tender meat and choicest wine, just in case you missed the wine first. On this mountain, he will swallow up the shroud that is over all the peoples, the woven covering that is over all the nations. He will swallow up death permanently. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from every face and remove his people's disgrace from all the earth. Indeed, the Lord has announced it. We have this beautiful picture, deeply challenging picture, of the culmination of all things when God gathers all the peoples of the earth and puts on a great banquet. But the shocking thing is that just as those who are invited eat, he also eats. What does he eat? On their tongues, on our tongues, is the taste of aged wine, tender meat, beautiful foods. And on the tastes of the Creator God is death. He will swallow up death permanently. He eats the shroud that is over the peoples. He eats death while we eat bread, wine, aged wine, tender meat. This is the picture of the God that we see revealed here in the scriptures, revealed here in us as a community. And what does Jesus say at the end of his ministry as he gathers his disciples? He says, come, eat. This is my body broken for you. Come, drink. This is my blood shed for you. The cost for our host, our Father God, is everything. He tastes death in order that we might come to his table and taste life. And it's amazing to me to think that the one thing that Jesus gives us, the early church, and the church to us now, as a right or like a way of doing something, a sort of repeating pattern, is communion. It's a meal. That's how we're to walk forward together as a community. We're to eat. He doesn't actually say spend 25 minutes singing worship songs, though clearly that was part of the early church way. That wasn't part of Jesus' instruction. Maybe because he thought we'd get that. He says, eat and drink together. Eat and drink together. And here, the implication of this passage is, you know what we're supposed to do as we go forward? How are we supposed to follow him? We're meant to eat and drink together and invite others, the poor, the blind, the lame, to eat and drink with us. And so what we're going to do right now is take communion.